Reading from Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin with a feature from this month's Sports Illustrated entitled Power Elite. Go ahead and deride the highest culture that gave birth to it, but now that it has an academy and a league turning out five-star prospects, there's no denying that Overtime Elite has fundamentally altered the basketball landscape. And this feature, written by Kevin Sweeney of Sports Illustrated, Austin Rivers, who played for seven teams over an 11-year NBA career, is only 32 years old. In other words, he's a little young to make, quote-unquote, these kids today rants. Yet there he was on his podcast called Off Guard last year, declaring, quote, highlight culture has killed the game of basketball, unquote. He is not alone with that sentiment. His sentiment, shared by countless coaches at every level of basketball, is simple. Young players, driven by the rush for attention and social media clout, are now too interested in producing viral moments and not interested enough in playing the game the quote-unquote right way. Call up any YouTube highlight reel and you'll see a parade of difficult off-the-dribble threes and celebrations after dunks. Extra passes that find the open man and diving attempts for loose balls, not so much. One of the biggest platforms for the modern highlight-driven hooper is called Overtime, the social media content upstart that has exploded since its launch in the year 2016, thanks to primarily short-term content capturing young players in action. A 10-minute video of Zion Williamson's final high school game from 2018 has more than 8 million views on Overtime Elite, a league for 16 to 19-year-olds initially positioned as an alternative for kids who didn't want to play college basketball. Plenty of people in the basketball world were skeptical. Was this the latest encroachment of highlight culture on a sport that desperately needed improvement to its youth development system? Corey Frazier, who is now Overtime Elite's head of player development, was coaching for the Bradley Beal Elite AAU team when he was first approached by Overtime. Quote, "The first question I asked, which I'm sure was everybody else's, was, is this just going to be a bunch of highlights and people dunking?" he says. Instead, Overtime, now in its fourth year, has become perhaps the best development program for young talent in the United States. In the past three NBA drafts, four alums have been top 10 picks, the same number as Kentucky, which has the most of any NCAA program. In May, an Overtime Elite under 18 team went to Berlin to compete at the Adidas Next Generation tournament and won two of its three games, beating powerhouse European clubs Barcelona and Berlin. And those leading the program believe that they are just getting started. Quote, "I'm constantly listening to people and their gripes about high school basketball development," unquote. Overtime head of competition Damian Wilkins says, "We try to implement those things here to make it a place that has literally no weaknesses," unquote. Overtime Elite hit the youth basketball scene as a disruptor, promising six-figure contracts to high school players to coax them away from the traditional college route and into an eight-team league based on a sparkling new facility in Atlanta. The first wave of players, which included eventual top five 2023 draft choices Amen and Asar Thompson, signed away their NCAA eligibility and became professionals. The goal, at least initially, was to build a pro league for players too young for the NBA's age minimum of 19 and land the best teenage talent in the world in the process. "I'm sure that college basketball hated us," Frazier says. But Overtime Elite's emergence came at the same time as drastic changes hit the landscape of college sports. Beginning in July of 2021, athletes could profit off their name, image, and likeness. Now that colleges could indirectly pay players, Overtime lost one of its key advantages in recruiting top talent. In response, Overtime began offering a quote-unquote scholarship option that doesn't pay players but allows them to finish their high school studies and remain eligible for college while playing for one of the prep teams in the Overtime Elite League. Every high school player who has signed on to join the program since the end of that first season has chosen the scholarship model, and Overtime has now become an essential stop for college coaches hunting for 4- and 5-star talent. That quick business model pivot presented an early challenge, but it didn't change the two quote-unquote North Stars of the league in the eyes of Overtime CEO Dan Porter. The first, create a top-tier basketball league that resonates with the Overtime audience. The second, develop, quote, the single best place to train to become a professional basketball player in the world, unquote. That hasn't changed whether they go to college, whether we pay them or not, Porter says. Building that best place to train required a multi-level approach. It started with hiring respected coaches, including Frazier, who had trained Beal and Jason Tatum as young players in St. Louis, as well as former college head coaches Kevin Ollie and Dave Latow. The facility, former Wizards general manager Tommy Shepard says, is, quote, NBA quality, unquote, with three NBA-sized courts, a weight room, and advanced technology that tracks every shot players take. And putting young players in an environment where they're surrounded by other top prospects help them level up their games and bodies even quicker. A lot of places, you probably get 3 or 4 high-level guys on the team. But to have 30 high-level guys in the building at one time, that's iron sharpening iron every day, Frazier says. You have your time, you have your workout plan, but you also have an I get to work out with somebody like me or even better than myself every single day, unquote. There's an academic component for those working towards a high school diploma, but the model at Overtime Elite more closely resembles that of the overseas basketball academies that are often propped up as the ideal youth development model. The top academies in Europe, they do an excellent job. I've been to those academies. They're not as equipped as OTE with the arena, the practice facility, and all their training opportunities, says Shepard, who was with the Wizards for 20 years. Frazier says that the training at OTE tries to model those European academies, but with an American slant. He wants players to learn a lot of the team-centric concepts that players in Europe learn quickly, like how to move without the ball and play in space, while also incorporating more individualized player development that preps overtime talent to create their own shot at the next level, a skill that's necessary to star in college and the NBA. But the primary parallel to an academy system for Overtime Elite is the number of touch points players have with coaches. Without the limitations that many state associations put on high school teams, players can get coached in multiple different settings every day rather than just putting up shots in an empty gym. For instance, five-star guard Jasper Johnson receives coaching outside his team's practice 3 times a day. Shots up before practice, a film session after class, and then a workout following the film session. This basketball factory is funded by Overtime's content empire, and essentially everything the players do while there feeds that beast. Streaming games is just the start. Workouts can be mic'd up for YouTube, team outings become blogs, and more players are getting in the podcast studio. Netflix's Formula One series, entitled Drive to Survive, has changed the landscape of sports content, and Overtime believes that it is positioned to create the next phase by following the journey of rising star talents, all while delivering it to the prized younger demographic that pro and college leagues are exhausting tons of energy trying to reach. Everybody in sports wants to make Drive to Survive, right? Says Porter. And that sounds like the gold standard of the thing. And we make One Shot, which is our version that is on Prime Video, who is our partner. But what would Drive to Survive look like if you dropped it on the floor and it broke into 200 pieces and each of those pieces was on TikTok every day? I think that's one of the things that we think about and have gotten much, much better at, unquote. That vision is what helps Overtime Elite to operate as a serious development system rather than as a sideshow for views or internet hype. The content to be real, raw, and authentic, not manufactured. Porter says that market research indicates that their audience is hunting inspiration, maybe not to be a future five-star recruit, but to make a high school team or simply level up their own game. They want to know how they can be like these players, Porter says. The more we can show the life behind the scenes, the workouts and the training, the more that they can connect with it, unquote. All that means the clash between what's best for content and what's best for basketball doesn't come up nearly as often as might be expected. senior forward Amari Evans, a Tennessee commit in his second year with OTE, says that he views them as, quote, two different worlds, unquote. The moments from games that become internet sensations don't happen if games are not competitive, and knowing everything's on file only ups the stakes for young players who are as focused on building their brands as they are their basketball careers. Quote, everything is going to get posted on social media, and none of our guys want to be on the wrong end of those clips, Wilkins says. Videos of 2024 lottery pick Rob Dillingham are still trending on social media from when he first came here. But that wasn't because Rob Dillingham came here and it wasn't competitive. He had to play well in those clips, and he played well against great competition, right? Unquote. That's not to say that Overtime doesn't embrace or even manufacture traits designed to appeal to a younger audience. Among the quirks of its games are the quote-unquote big bonus, a power play-like rule that briefly gives teams a 5-on-3 fast break after fouls rather than free throws. I would rather watch an elite prep school game than an overtime elite game. They let those kids play like pros, says one SEC assistant. Now the infrastructure and the daily routines, that's better. But the games, unquote. Overtime's fourth season of games got underway in November with top recruits like Johnson, who is committed to Kentucky, Malik Thomas, who's committed to Arkansas, and Bryson Tiller, who's committed to Kansas, the headliners of this week's senior class of prospects. In the U.S., at least, there's no one place with more prep talent than OTEHQ. So what's next? Wilkins mentions potentially expanding to add two more teams. Porter is thinking globally after having top-tier international prospects like French big man Alexander Sarr, who is now with the Wizards. Spanish forward Ezon Almansa, who is playing professionally in Australia. And Brazilian wing Samis Calderon, who also signed with Kansas, coming through the program. Overtime Elite has already done broadcasts in French and wants to dip into Portuguese next, given basketball's growth in Brazil. And the coaches and administrators would like to continue playing in events like the Next Gen tournament, where hopefully they can show the rest of the world what they are truly about. I think oftentimes people see what we do on social media, and they define us from that, Wilkins says. But that's just audience building. We go play wherever we're able to play, and we just kind of let the work speak from there. But at the same time, we're also constantly sharing what we do and pushing Overtime Elite to those people, helping them understand that we are a valid basketball development destination that puts in a lot of time with our guys, unquote. OTE's rise to relevance has been swift. To Shepherd, whether that's because of or in spite of its new way of doing things, is moot. It comes down to one thing, players. You know, people can say whatever they want, but you're going to go evaluate their talent, he says. They have NBA-level talent in their pipeline. So if you don't like certain things or certain aspects, you know you've still got to go where the talent is, unquote. And again, that feature is entitled Overtime Elite. The upstart league is changing the college and pro hoops landscape. written by Sports Illustrated writer Kevin Sweeney. And in another feature from the latest Sports Illustrated, headline reads, The Good Fight. The first undisputed heavyweight champ in 24 years, Ukraine's Oleksandr Usyk is ready to defend his title to inspire those defending his war-torn country. And this feature is written by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Hours after achieving what once seemed impossible, a victory over Tyson Fury that followed back-to-back wins over Anthony Joshua, establishing Oleksandr Usyk as the undisputed heavyweight champion, Usyk's emotions overwhelmed him. I miss my father, Usyk said, choking up in a room full of reporters. Oleksandr Usyk Sr. died in the year 2012, days after his son won gold at the London Olympics. Usyk had no bigger supporter than his dad, a military man who took up farming when the family moved from Simferopol, a city on the Crimean Peninsula, into the Ukrainian countryside. It was Senior who taught Oleksandr how to fight, who steered him to the right trainers, who told anyone that would listen that his son, the skinny kid with a gap tooth, was destined for greatness. I have absolutely no idea where his true belief in me came from, says Usyk. Days before Oleksandr was scheduled to return home from London, Senior passed. When the son arrived, his father was already in his coffin. Oleksandr slipped the medal into his hand and walked away. Usyk says his father still visits him before fights, a smiling image that comes to him in dreams. He was there in May before Usyk stepped into the ring with Fury, a towering heavyweight, officially listed at 6'9" and 262 pounds, who made Usyk's sturdy 6'3", 223-pound frame look several weight classes smaller by comparison. Usyk flipped the script that night, taking the fight to Fury, knocking the undefeated champion down in the ninth round en route to a narrow split decision win. Afterwards, Fury admitted that Usyk was better than he expected. Usyk, tears welling in his eyes, said that he hoped that he made his father proud. It's late October, and Usyk is speaking over a Zoom call from Valencia, Spain, where he is holding training camp for his rematch with Fury, which is scheduled for December 21st in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Camp, Usyk says, has been quote-unquote excellent, flashing a smile through his still toothy grin. If Usyk's boxing skills have made him arguably the best fighter of this generation, his dry humor has made him one of the most endearing. In 2020, his social media posts calling out British heavyweight Derek Chisora went viral, and his humorous interview quotes like, "I am feel, I am very feel," in response to the usual "How are you feeling?" question, have been reprinted on T-shirts. A week before Halloween, Usyk arrived at a press conference to promote the Fury rematch, dressed as Agent 47, the popular character from the Hitman video game. Behind the smiles, though, is a palpable heaviness. In February of 2022, Russia invaded Ukraine, escalating a war that had begun nearly a decade earlier. Suddenly, the country his father loved was being torn apart. Among the earliest images beamed across the world was of Usyk sheltering in his home in Kiev, describing what was happening live on CNN. Quote, "My soul belongs to the Lord," he said. "My body and my honor belong to my country," unquote. In the weeks that followed, Usyk joined the territorial defense, patrolling the streets with a rifle over his shoulder. "I prayed that I didn't get shot," he says, "and I prayed that I didn't have to shoot anybody," unquote. There have been more than 1 million casualties since the start of the Russian offensive. More than 400,000 Ukrainians have been wounded, according to estimates, with more than 80,000 killed. As the fighting nears its third year, there is no end in sight. As Usyk nears his rematch with Fury, he insists that there is only one fight that matters. "Ukraine," says Usyk, "has to win," unquote. Growing up, both Usyk's parents were farmers, and if he knew anything, it was that he didn't want to do that. "I thought I was special," says Usyk. "Soccer came first, then boxing, which became a lifestyle 2 months in when he battered a more seasoned amateur during a sparring session. He turned pro in 2013. Quote, "A hurricane came into the boxing world," unquote, says his former promoter, Eddie Hearn, storming through the less-than-glamorous cruiserweight division to become undisputed champion almost 5 years later. After a couple of test-the-waters fights at heavyweight, he took on Joshua, defeating the hard-hitting champion on his home soil in September of 2021. He beat Joshua again nearly a year later, then knocked out another Brit, Daniel Dubois, in August of 2023, before besting Fury in a split decision victory in May to become the first undisputed heavyweight champion of the four-belt era. "Can you imagine how much pressure this man had?" marvels Vladimir Klitschko, the former heavyweight champion who was ringside watching his countryman's win over Fury. Quote, "He was fighting for all Ukrainians," unquote. Sometimes Usyk wonders if he should have been fighting at all. When Russia invaded, he quickly headed home. With Ukraine's airports closed, he flew to Poland, driving nearly 500 miles from Warsaw to Kiev. His plan was to join the military. "My friends told me that they would never let me in," he says. "The territorial defense, which was more of a well-armed police force, was the next best option. I was just hoping for our regular army guys for their success," says Usyk, "so they don't allow the enemy to come closer to us, and I will not have to shoot," unquote. A few months into the invasion, Usyk was approached by Vitali Klitschko, Vladimir's brother, himself a former heavyweight champ who has served as mayor of Kiev since 2014. Growing up, Usyk admired the Klitschkos. When Usyk traveled to amateur tournaments, he would get quizzical looks when he said that he was from Ukraine, a country that formally gained its independence in the year 1991. The Klitschkos, who rose to prominence in the early 2000s, legitimized it. "People immediately recognized the country," says Usyk, "not for presidents or politicians, but for the athletes," unquote. Vitali appreciated Usyk's desire to defend his homeland, but he believed that he could do more good from outside of it. "I did not want to leave," says Usyk. I was given an assignment to resume my career because Ukraine needed as much exposure in the media as possible, unquote. Initially, says Usyk, focusing on training was challenging. It tried to break me, he says. He thought about his friends serving on the front line, many of whom he grew up boxing with. Every time it felt difficult, I imagined what it was like for them, says Usyk. When he returned to Ukraine between fights, he would visit them. When Usyk suggested that he could be more useful there, they told him to focus on his own job. And, says Usyk, to go away, unquote. Usyk did, though his family, his wife Yekaterina, and their two daughters stayed behind. Usyk's sons, Criillo and Mikhailo, live in Spain with their grandparents. Once, Usyk called his daughter, Yelizaveta, to tell her about flooding near his training camp. The roads were closed and the supermarkets were cleaned out. Papa, Yelizaveta said, we have 500 kilogram bombs exploding here. They are not afraid, says Usyk. No fear, unquote. Still, the separation from his family has been difficult. When the fight with Fury, originally scheduled for February, was postponed due to a facial injury Fury suffered in training, Usyk elected to stay in camp. He missed holidays and birthdays, and when his youngest daughter, Maria, was born, Usyk wasn't there. Soldiers were sacrificing every day for Ukraine, he reasoned. He should be willing to do the same. There are three major things that either kill a man or allow him to live, says Usyk. The first who got broken were the ones who thought it would end soon. The second who got broken were the ones who thought that it would never end. The ones who survive are the ones who have a goal to win and follow their goal, unquote. Across Ukraine, Usyk's victory over Fury was celebrated. Ukrainians hit hard, President Vladimir Zelensky posted on social media. Vitaly Klitschko said that Usyk showed the world that Ukrainians are capable of defeating a strong opponent in a difficult fight, unquote. When Usyk returned to his locker room, his phone was hot from all the incoming messages. One, however, stood out. It was a video from a group of soldiers on the front line. Details of the fight had been disseminated via walkie-talkie. According to Usyk, when news of his win spread, the platoon was inspired to push forward and reclaim another 100 meters of ground. They feel so much confidence in themselves, says Usyk. They are going through some really hard times now, but they are so confident in what they do and in the result that they do some absolutely extraordinary things. The reason why it's so important for Ukraine to win is because Ukraine plays the role of a deterrent for Europe and the rest of the world. Russia wants as much as possible, and the moment there is nothing in between, they will bring a lot of sorrow to the other territories. Ukraine is fighting for everyone, and we will win, unquote. Towards the end of the 45-minute call, Usyk's smile returns. Wins over Joshua and Fury have formed the foundation of an incomparable legacy. No fighter has ever gone undisputed in cruiserweight and heavyweight in the four-belt era, and it is unlikely any will again. Usyk's career earnings stand at more than $80 million, some of which he pumps into the Usyk Foundation, a nonprofit that supplies Ukraine with everything from humanitarian aid to the cash to buy weapons. For the rematch with Fury, he will earn tens of millions more. Winning will be difficult. The first fight was competitive, with one judge scoring in favor of Fury. But it's nothing compared to what his family and countrymen are facing every day. As the interview ends, he stretches back in a chair. "I must rest," says Usyk. "One more training today." Pausing, he looks into the camera for one final word. Quote unquote, Ukraine. And again, that feature is entitled The Good Fight. The first undisputed heavyweight champion in 24 years, Ukraine's Oleksandr Usyk is ready to defend his title to inspire those defending his war-torn country. Written by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. And among memorable sporting events for 2024, we'll always have Paris. Magnificent venues, spirited fans, and unforgettable performances by the world's best athletes, all against the backdrop of historic Paris landmarks. The 2024 Summer Olympics were unlike any other, and worth one last look through the eyes of those who covered the games for Sports Illustrated, starting with swimming at La Défense Arena. When is the only time that a swimming venue has sounded like an SEC football stadium? On July 31st in Paris, La Défense Arena, when Frenchman Léon Marchand made history in his home country by winning two individual gold medals in a single night in two grueling and disparate races, the 200-meter butterfly followed by the 200-meter breaststroke. Parisians were raucous every evening at the pool, but they elevated the noise level to deafening while watching the king, or le roi Léon, author a thrilling comeback in the final 50 meters to win the butterfly event, then dominate the breaststroke from start to finish less than 2 hours later. Quote, "I could hear underwater that the pool was going crazy," unquote, he said afterward. Exhausted but exhilarated after completing one of the most audacious doubles in swimming history, the 22-year-old Marchand bathed in the adulation, the high point of what would be a four gold medal tour de force at the 2024 Olympic Games. Another great venue for sports at the Paris Olympics was fencing at the Grand Palais. In Tokyo and London, Olympic fencers competed in convention centers. Their uniforms should have included, "Hello, my name is," stickers on the chest. In Paris, fencers competed at the Grand Palais, a building that opened in the year 1900 for the Universal Exhibition and is dedicated to, quote, "the glory of French art," unquote. With an iron, steel, and glass barrel-vaulted ceiling, mint-green columns, and moody lighting, the competitors appeared to be fighting in medieval duels. Fencing is a niche sport of repeated stops and starts, and in the wrong venue, it can feel inaccessible. When the team of Lee Kiefer, Lauren Scruggs, Jackie Dubrovich, and Maya Weintraub captured the first ever gold medal for the U.S. women's foil squad beneath the largest glass roof in Europe, it felt like the culmination of a sprawling epic. The next scene during the Paris Olympics was track and field that took place at the Stade de France. The scene on the night of August the 4th for the men's 100-meter final at the Paris Olympics projected the glitzy, star-studded, and distinctly American performance to come. Inside Stade de France, it felt more like a blockbuster heavyweight prize fight than the shortest of all sprints. The backdrop, a DJ spinning deep house, flashing lights in sync with the beat, and a roaring crowd of more than 70,000. Athlete entrances fit for pro wrestling. And Noah Lyles, the 27-year-old sprinter, helped push his sport into a wider spotlight this summer with a Netflix docuseries released shortly before the Olympic Games. Many didn't love it. Many didn't love him. But on that night, Noah Lyles spoke only with his speed. He won his first gold in an awe-inspiring photo finish. On that same track in Paris, Sydney McLaughlin Lavrone became the unrivaled queen of the 400-meter hurdles, lowering her world record and capturing a second straight Olympic gold in the event. Headliner Sha'Carri Richardson made a remarkable comeback from a slow start in the women's 100-meter final to snag a silver and stormed back as the anchor for the gold medal-winning 4x100-meter relay squad. The U.S. track and field team finished with 34 medals overall, its highest tally in 40 years. Then there was the tennis event at the Olympics in Paris at Roland Garros. And he was an old man who stood alone on the clay, having gone 4 previous Olympics without winning a gold medal dating back to Beijing in 2008. He was nursing a right knee injury just 2 months removed from surgery to repair a torn meniscus. But Novak Djokovic was also, in the words of Carlos Alcaraz, quote-unquote, hungry Novak, and that was enough. Enough to beat the healthy, rising Spaniard. Enough to win the elusive gold for his beloved Serbia, a country that gained its independence in the year 2006. The 37-year-old Djokovic is revered at home, and the feeling is mutual. That is why the man with 24 Grand Slam singles titles called this golden moment, quote, probably the biggest sporting success I've had in my career, unquote. Another memorable event from the Paris Olympics came in soccer. Espresso is made through a combination of high concentration and high pressure, and in Paris, the women who call themselves Triple Espresso thrived with high concentration under high pressure. Mallory Swanson, Sophia Smith, and Trinity Rodman of the U.S. women's national team scored more goals in the Olympics than any other squad, but even that undersells their gold medal performance. They combine youthful athleticism with veteran poise. They expected to not just play great, but to play great together. Veteran Crystal Dunn marveled at their development. Quote, this young group enjoys the journey because I think they understand now that it's not just about putting your jersey on, it's about doing the work. Unquote. And finally, a most memorable sporting event during the Paris Olympics was the beach volleyball that took place at Eiffel Tower Stadium. The hottest ticket in Paris this summer was for a sport that doesn't even have a proper word in French. The DJ at Le Beach Volley Stadium, set up in the shadow of the Eiffel Tower on the Champ de Mars, blasted Edith Piaf at all hours of the day. The sold-out crowds of 12,860 formed conga lines and did the wave. Gameplay paused at sunset for a tower light show. At times, you could almost forget that they were playing for Olympic gold. And again, that's a summary of some of the big events that took place in the Paris Olympics this year. And next, we turn to the scorecard section of Sports Illustrated, where the essay reads, "That stinks. Ugly feet and ugly behavior balanced out the good in 2024, starting with grazed anatomy. Pole vaulter Anthony Ammirati of France became a viral sensation at the Summer Games in Paris after knocking the bar off with his spandexed bulge. And he takes his work home after the Indiana Pacers beat the Milwaukee Bucks for the fourth time last season. Giannis Antetokounmpo said, quote, "When you go home and sleep and wake up, you think about it. When you go back and work out, you think about it. When you're about to get freaky at night, you think about it," unquote. Then there is No Mercy on the Mercy. The 11-year-old participant in a charity fundraiser was in tears after the two penalty kicks that he took at halftime of a Chelsea against Liverpool game were saved on dives by former Reds keeper David James, who told a UK morning show host, quote, "The thing is, Rick, I don't let in penalties," unquote. Then there's the single-digit win, where Australian field hockey player Matt Dawson chose to have the top inch of his injured right ring finger amputated rather than miss the Olympics. Then there's Mookie's Wilson. When Mookie Betts caught a foul ball at the wall during Game 4 of the World Series in New York, one Yankees fan pried open the Dodger outfielder's glove while another immobilized his throwing hand. Then there is Gronk's Bombers. Former Patriots tight end Rob Gronkowski recognized the first fan as a quote-unquote maniac buddy from the University of Arizona and congratulated him for, quote, "shining when your moment came," unquote. Then there's the case of the odds aren't good. According to Major League Baseball investigators, infielder Tucapita Marcano, who in June was banned for life from the sport for betting on games while a member of the Pittsburgh Pirates, won only 4.3% of his 387 wagers that he placed. Then there's the case when the goods are odd. The first 1,000 fans to the Altoona Curve game on April the 13th received a Paul Skeens quote-unquote bobble stash doll with a pivoting soup strainer. Then there's no end in sight, where the Delta Center in New York City, home to the Utah Hockey Club of the NHL, offers 5,000 seats with no view of one net. Next, there is the Sleevey Wonder, the jersey that Babe Ruth wore while making his quote-unquote called shot in the 1932 World Series, sold at auction in August for over $24 million. "It don't stop till the casket drop," exclaimed Snoop Dogg on NBC during a long men's doubles badminton rally at the Olympics. "I see Tommy John's Tommy John's, the thinner, lighter, cheaper-looking Major League Baseball uniforms that Nike unveiled in spring training unwittingly featured see-through pants. Then a man accused of stealing a golf cart was apprehended by police after leading them on a low-speed vehicular chase through the streets of Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And after Vanderbilt upset top-ranked Alabama in football, fans tore down a goalpost, marched it through Nashville, and threw it into the Cumberland River. And then, without ever straying from his row in the second deck of the Oakland Coliseum, a fan at an Oakland A's game caught three foul balls in a single inning. And a Mariners fan seated 330 feet from home plate in Seattle caught foul balls on two consecutive pitches in May. After a postal worker choked on a lobster roll at a competitive eating contest in Meredith, New Hampshire, and was Heimlicked by the state's governor and a paramedic, he resumed speed eating. And in September, Joey Chestnut ate 83 hot dogs in 10 minutes to smash his previous world record by 7 francs on the live Netflix special entitled Chestnut vs. Kobayashi, Unfinished Beef. And in other off-the-wall happenings this past year, the paper napkin on which an Argentine agent scrawled the agreement in the year 2000 to sell 13-year-old Lionel Messi to Barcelona sold at auction for $965,000. And in other sports news, musher Dallas Seavey won a record 6th Iditarod in March despite a 2-hour penalty for insufficiently gutting the moose that he had shot in defense of his dogs on the first day of the 1,000-mile sled race in Alaska. And the last of the 8 bulls that escaped a rodeo held in the parking lot of a mall in Massachusetts was captured more than 24 hours later on U.S. Highway 1. And finally, there was the Yager Heister of 2024. 19,000 bobblehead dolls in the likeness of retired Penguin star Jaromir Jagr were stolen by cargo thieves in March and recovered nearly 2 weeks later by a joint task force of agents from the FBI and the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. And in the Sports Illustrated Faces in the Crowd section, we have a top shot in the tennis world. Amiya Bowles found tennis by necessity until 4 years ago. She mainly ran track, played basketball, and swam. But when the pandemic limited her participation in those sports, she would go to any court she could find with her dad and hit for a couple of hours. Amiya gradually improved, entered ITF tournaments, and more than made up for lost time. In October, the Bexley, Ohio High Junior defeated Genevieve Hayden of Orange High 6-4, 6-1 to win her third consecutive state title and extend her unbeaten streak to 56 matches. The 16-year-old, who has only dropped one set in her high school career, has already received more than 20 college offers. Her serve has been registered at 106 miles per hour. I have another persona on the court. It's fiery and aggressive, says Amiya, who is looking to make the junior field at Wimbledon and the U.S. Open in 2025. I feel a lot more confident in myself, and that self-confidence comes from tennis, unquote. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Illustrated. Again, my name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's reading of Sports Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.